Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We have two things coming up this hour. First, I said earlier, as long as the people of Egypt are standing up and facing the police and doing it nonviolently all through Cairo and Egypt, all through Alexandria, to change the nature of the society, we're going to have them on the show every day to hear their story because they deserve to have all of us stand in solidarity with them. So we'll be talking with two folks from Cairo and also Nancy Youssef, who is an American-Egyptian who is former Baghdad bureau chief from McClatchy Newspapers. Then we'll talk about stuff close to the home, about what's going on in East Baltimore, the five-part series in the Daily Record. We have the leaders of the East Baltimore Development Incorporated here with us and two other folks as well to talk about that and talk about the future of that part of our community as well. So stay with us for all that. Right now we turn this over to traffic. Make sure you know which way to go, which way not to go. We'll be right back with a conversation, so please do not go away.
Support for WEAA is provided by Luna. Information on flooring available at luna.com/traffic or 877-241-LUNA.
Traffic this time around is a service of Children's Advil and a little bit of good news on the accident, which was a closure on the east side beltway. The accident scene was the interloop just prior to Pulaski Highway. Right now, two left lanes are getting by. Still major delays all the way around from the 83s into Parkville and down past Perry Hall to the scene over in Middle River. A little extra time needed on the inner loop as well. Checking into a crash in the city along Loch Raven at Cold Spring Lane, just called out. Also Edmondson at Swan on the west side. Earlier problem along Solomon's Island at Forest Drive down in the parole stretch heading toward Annapolis is in the clearing stages, but it does look like police still on the scene. Baltimore at Castle structure fire in the working stages as well. For more information, log on to SigAlert.com. Matt Taka, Baltimore area traffic.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, reminding you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, you can go to www.mecu.com or go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. All the information is there as well. As we will be doing every day until Egypt is free, we will be talking to folks in Egypt, folks who are covering Egypt, folks who care about what's going on. We are joined once again by Nancy Youssef, who is the Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. She is also an Egyptian-American who will be going to Egypt shortly to cover that story. It's always a pleasure to have her on the air. Nancy, welcome. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Dina Yahia is with us. She is on the phone from Cairo. She's a graduate of the American University in Cairo and has lived in Egypt all her life. And Yahia Salah El-Din is with us, who is an ophthalmologist. I think her father is on the phone with us as well from Cairo. And welcome to both of you as well.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Dina. And Yahia Salah El-Din is with us as well?
Yeah, hello.
Hello, welcome. So tell us first about today and what is going on. Dina, why don't you start and tell us what you experienced today and what we in the world need to hear about what's going on in Tahrir Square.
First of all, I would like to thank you for having us on your show. And today, I went with my brother and my cousin. We went to the demonstrations to Tahrir Square. Today wasn't like a million people gathering or anything, so we know it will be a smaller number of people, so you could walk around and get a sense of who still stays while, like, others go home. And, like, you get, you're more likely to actually talk with people. There's less noise. And it's actually interesting because today, for the first time, I entered from a different entrance because they closed all the entrance, all the entrances to Tahrir Square except like two. And one's really crowded, the one that we usually take, but the one that we took today is the one from the American University in Cairo. And passing there, I had to use the bathroom. So and there were like nothing opened. And then they were like, oh, McDonald's, go to McDonald's. McDonald's was ransacked. Like, there was the place is completely destroyed. You go in, people, like, windows are crashed, and like the whole place smells terrible. I was just telling Cole today that it smells like my dad is telling me to, like, move on and go to the point. And the point is that, no, like, the reason why I say this is because this is one of the reasons, like, one of the problems that people don't maybe get or talk about is the fact that thousands and thousands of people stay in Tahrir Square, and there's, like, a huge, like, sewage problem. Like, today they were building, people were building on their own. They were building, they were getting pipes, and they were building bathrooms. Like, I saw when we were walking around, there were a couple of men. They were, like, they had pipes, and they were breaking. We didn't understand what they were doing. They looked like they were building... They looked like they were building something. So I walked up and I asked, like, what's going on? They're like, we're building more bathrooms. And I was like, is this a government thing? He's like, government? And he looked offended. He's like, this is our own money. And, like, the point is the people in Tahrir Square, they're not going anywhere. And they're, like, building their own, they're sustaining their own resources.
That's a great story.
I don't know if my dad would like to say something.
I would like to hear him. Dr. Yahya Salah Al-Din, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Yes, thank you for having us. But I want to talk about the people in Tahrir. Yesterday we were there. Usually from last Friday it's asked that we go out for this huge demonstrations, Sundays, Tuesdays, and Fridays. And I finished my work in the morning, and I went because there is the problem here now, the government and the media, public media, they are making a lot of confusion to the people. At the beginning, they were giving completely wrong stories about what's going on in Tahrir and other demonstrations. And the problem is that they are focusing about Tahrir. It's not only Tahrir, it's all over Egypt.
That's important.
And, they're focusing about Tahrir and this, like, a bunch of young people that are want to make some noise, and they are talking about like a few kids, but it's all of Egypt is represented there, but the same thing is happening all over the country. But there is something evil they are doing. They have tried many things. I have never been, unfortunately, into any demonstrations because they were very clever over the years to make us everybody encircled in his own circle. And with this, really, I call it a revolution. I went from the first demonstrations for the first time in my life, with my younger son, and I saw it. What made me to continue, because we all the past years we were talking about. The quality of people is bad. We have lost a lot of the good things. There is a lot of corruption. There is nobody's respecting anything, even the qualities between people. But suddenly in the demonstration, I saw all these qualities are coming back. That's why I made it. I could walk 12 kilometers to Tahrir Square from where I live, south of this place, 12 kilometers, among all people of all classes. Old people, young people, you feel completely, I felt it, like a lot of dust is removed from all over the people. People are behaving excellent. Everything is completely, completely peaceful until we met the police where they hit very, very cruelly. But then things evolved very nicely. The feeling of freedom made more people to join later on. All the time, more people joining. And when you go to Tahrir Square, you feel it's a different world. The people are behaving differently. For a long time, maybe it's not for you, as in the West, everything is organized. People are used to follow the rules because they know they will get the rights. But here, either you know somebody or you crowd over. You don't queue. We don't have a culture of queue. But you could see yesterday of queuing. The people are queuing, and people like thousands and thousands inside all the lies that we have, they were putting it into it, that girls, veiled or unveiled, all the things that the Fightless Muslim Brotherhood, they are only part of the society, they are not the leaders. Everybody is talking about Egypt. Everybody is behaving different. You feel really a different sense. You feel Egypt is evolving. The critical thing is that the government is trying to play around this revolution and splitting people and trying to push poor people against richer people, which is not the case. Everybody in the square is the same. All rich people, most of the people, a lot of the people are really very well-to-do.
Your stories are just are inspiring, and they're also kind of giving us a vivid picture of what we don't see a lot in our own media. And I want to talk to one of our leading journalists, who is I think one of my favorite journalists, because she braved the streets of Baghdad to bring stories home, and she's just an intrepid reporter and a really deep thinker. And Nancy Youssef, who's now the Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And Nancy, as a reporter, but also as a journalist, but also as an Egyptian American, as a woman whose roots are in Egypt, whose family's members are in Egypt, tell me what you're seeing and what you just heard and what your analysis of all this is.
Well, I think today I've been following in particular the protests going on throughout Egypt, because what I'm curious is what's happening now outside of Tahrir Square.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, if it moves beyond that, it's much harder to manage. You know, if there are 100,000 people in Tahrir Square and the army nearby protecting government institutions and the like, that's a much more manageable situation than if you've got 100,000 scattered throughout the country protesting. That's not a place where the army can intervene, and it falls on the police, who are, of course, far less trusted than the army is. And so as I'm watching today, I'm wondering, is the situation deteriorating? Now, you'll remember that just this past Sunday, there seemed to be an air of confidence coming from the United States that the situation had come under control. Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Secretary Robert Gates, the defense secretary, hadn't called their counterpart since Sunday. And we heard Hillary Clinton on the Sunday shows essentially say that the situation's under control. But today, as I'm watching what's happening, I'm wondering if, in fact, the situation is indeed getting worse and spreading amid these growing calls for Mubarak to step down.
Now, I want to say to listen, we only can stay here a few more minutes, but tomorrow we'll have an hour-long conversation with our guest you're hearing here today and others in Egypt. So we'll get a full story, because we have another story we have to cover here today that's happening in Baltimore. If you go to the website... the Facebook page, We Are All Khaled Said is the name of the Facebook page. They are talking on that page about things happening all over Egypt. They're saying that 3 were killed and 100 wounded in clashes in Karga, in Al-Wadi Al-Ghadid, in central Egypt. So this is spreading across Egypt. It's in Alexandria. It's in Cairo. It's all across. And I think that's the sense of the magnitude of this is... is not really well understood here. We follow Cairo, but it's everywhere. And so very quickly, because we do have to take a break here, and we'll come back tomorrow with Dr. Yahya Salah al-Din and his daughter, Dina Yahya, as well as Nancy Youssef. But in closing this out, I mean, are you in touch, doctor, with folks around the country?
Yes, I have family around the country, and the same feeling, the same solidarity. But the problem now is that the longer the time the process is taking, it's like the journalist was saying, Nancy, that it can get out of control. Now the rhythm is the same. Everybody is very conscious about preserving public anything in the country. Everybody is talking about positive ideas. All the time people are talking about real new Egypt and behavior in management, how to help the economy, how to boost everything up. But the delay in response from the government is giving a chance to this to go out of control, and I think none of us will need this.
That's deliberate.
Nancy, do you want to have a thought here before we let Dina, do you want to have a quick thought, then we'll go to Nancy to close out?
Yeah, the quick thought, I think the government has to immediately take action to resolve this, to give away the demands.
Nancy?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I would just add that these next few days, once again, are another critical metric in terms of where things are going. There's been talk about another large protest on Friday. And the question becomes, how long can the government stay in place and try to maintain some semblance of the status quo, given these rising protests? and expanding protests, if you will, outside of Tahrir Square. So we'll watch once again, but I think for viewers, it's watching what's happening in Tahrir Square, and more importantly, what's happening not only outside of it, but in those backroom channels that we're not, we don't have access to, the negotiation that's going on. So it's sort of, there are three areas as a viewer to watch for, not just Tahrir Square, but what's going on around it.
And Dina, you'll be going back down tomorrow?
Yes, probably. And Friday.
So we will talk to Dr. Yahya Salah al-Din and his daughter Dina Yahya and others in Egypt tomorrow. We'll have that recording for you tomorrow at 6 o'clock on this program. We'll be talking to them earlier in the day, and Nancy Youssef as well. I want to thank you, Dina and Yahya, for your courage and strength for standing up for freedom and democracy. It's just stunning to all of us, and we're going to be talking to you every day. As long as you're out there standing, we'll be standing with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Nancy Youssef, thank you so much for taking this brief time with us, and we look forward to talking to you again more tomorrow, and thank you for all the work you do as well.
Thank you so much.
We take a brief break, and we will talk to Egypt again tomorrow, and every day, as long as they're there, we will be there with them. We are going to come right back and talk about East Baltimore. The Daily Record did this five-part series, we have Doug Nelson, who's president and CEO of the N.E. Casey Foundation, who just retired from that, or is retiring from that, is chairman of the board of the East Baltimore Development Incorporated. Chris Shea is their president and CEO. He is with us, along with Joshua Garoon, who's a Kellogg Health Scholar at Hopkins, and Shabria Thomas, who's community organizer and former SMEAC employee. Stay with us. We'll be right back within minutes. Don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. There was a five-part series in the Daily Record talking about the East Baltimore Development Corporation, and we've covered this over the years a lot, since the beginning of it, actually, and all the controversies that surrounded it then about what was going to happen in East Baltimore. Was the biotech park going to be built? What about the Middle East community and the people who live there? What was going to happen to them? And there were people, I do believe, of goodwill on both sides here who seem to be at loggerheads and what is happening there. And this, and when we had the show the other day where we interviewed both reporters, Melody Simmons and Joan Jacobson, we got a series of phone calls from people saying that the article was not true, not factual. You don't know the whole story. And we always believe in having the whole story here. And I do know the two reporters very well, and they're two of the best investigative journalists that I know. So we have in the studio with us now Doug Nelson, who is chairman of the board of the East Baltimore Development Incorporated and is also president and CEO of the N.E. Case Foundation, which is deeply involved in the East Baltimore project. Christopher Shea is president and CEO of the East Baltimore Development Incorporated. We have with us Shabria Thomas, who is community organizer and former SMEAC employee, and that was the Middle East community group that was organized to keep their community alive, and Joshua Garoon, who is a Kellogg Health Scholar at Johns Hopkins and has been involved in this from the beginning as well. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all in our studio.
Thank you.
And y'all can join us out there, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, to become part of this conversation. Let me begin, I guess, in when we look at this story. And I'm curious, in looking at this story, if I might start with whoever wants to start this, Chris or Doug, what was it that you took so much umbrage at in the story that we covered the other day about the East Baltimore Development Project? I'd like to hear you begin that way, if we could. Doug Nelson.
Happy to, Mark, and thanks for having us. You know, the 20 years I spent at the Annie Casey Foundation sort of brought us into partnerships with local governments and community organizations in 20 or 30 neighborhoods around the country that we were trying to be a partner in strengthening those communities to achieve more success for low-income children and their families.
Mm-hmm.
And up against that experience across the whole country, I don't think that there is a project, an initiative, a vision that is more ambitious, more difficult, more complex, more fundamental than what's being tried in East Baltimore. It simply is as challenging an assault on what has been generational neglect and disinvestment with terrible consequences for poor kids and their families in that neighborhood. And so I say that by way of introduction because I think Joan and Melody ended up with a perspective on the last 8 years in East Baltimore that that saw the glass a quarter empty. I think that everything those of us who've been close to this project week in and week out for the last 8 years and everybody who has taken into account the worst financial collapse and real estate crisis, you know, in a generation, I see East Baltimore's progress as a glass three-quarters full. And so at every level, my sense that Melody and Joan characterized the history and status of this project in a way that was sometimes plainly inaccurate, oftentimes contextually unfair, and in some ways a little bit insulting to the values and the vision of a whole cast of stakeholders who have contributed money, sweat, tears, and idealism to this project. So I think there's a case to be made, and we have tried to make it and are this week responding to people all over Baltimore in terms of our perspective on what's happening in East Baltimore. It's much more hopeful, which acknowledges much more progress, and which tries to get people back to what I think is a fundamental issue in combating poverty in the United States, and that is, can we find, and I by no means think this is easy, but can we find a way for the public sector, the private sector, the philanthropic sector, and community to work together and invest deeply in concentrated poverty neighborhoods in a way that benefits poor people? If we do not learn to do that, the issue of urban poverty and its multi-generational dimensions is simply going to go unaddressed. There's going to be no path forward. And so I think that's what East Baltimore is all about. It is a noble experiment undertaken across sectors in this community to find a way whether you can invest in poor urban neighborhoods with social justice as the result. And that is damn difficult, and I think that there is some evidence that we're learning with mistakes, mm-hmm. but we're learning how to do that.
Well, let me ask you this question. You guys, please jump in here as much as you like, and we're going to open the phones here, 410-319-8888. For your own thoughts on this, that one of the things that Melody Simmons, I must say this, one of the lead investigators in this piece, along with Joan Jacobson for Daily Record, said to me was that she told me earlier today that they stand behind the facts of the story 100%. That there's nothing that they say is everything they say is factual. That the stuff that they research. And so the question is, what is it about the facts that aren't correct? In this story, I mean, one of the questions they're raising is we have all this money that was borrowed by this city, given to this project, federal money, state money as well. And one of the things they're asking in the story is, does the community not have a right to know how that money was spent, mm-hmm. given where the project is now, which is not where it was supposed to be when it was first announced to us years ago when we had this program in the beginning?
Well, it's certainly a very complex project, but there's actually a certain simplicity and elegance to the financing of it. In fact, none of the public money runs through EBDI. The federal funds were expended by the city of Baltimore on eligible activities. The state funds are expended by the city of Baltimore on eligible activities. The city's funds, general GO bond funds and other funds, are expended by the city of Baltimore on eligible activities, whereas the private activities, the private financing of EBDI is used to fund our core operating expenses, our programmatic activities, our family advocates, our comprehensive case managers, our workforce development program, et cetera. That is all funded privately. So there are many, many layers of public review from the Department of Housing, with independent reviews from the Comptroller's Office, to the Department of General Services at the state, to the Board of Public Works and the Board of Estimates, which all of which govern the expenditure and supervise and oversee the expenditure of the public funding aspect of this. And I think the issue of disputing whether the articles were factually correct or not, I don't think that's particularly material. But the difficulty I think people like I have with the reporting was that that structure, those facts were made clearly known to the reporters. And yet they were reported in very different ways. There's a presumption in the articles that somehow EBDI has either misspent or hidden the way it has spent public funds, when in fact public funds don't flow through our organization. That's an example of the challenge we have when we review these articles. And it's a very complex project. It's perhaps not amenable to this type of investigation and expose. Maybe there are other approaches to journalism that could better communicate this, but I don't think it was the nuances of this were effectively.
I have to jump in.
Shabria Thomas,
thank you. Because I think that it is a misrepresentation to utilize terms such as progress when there is documents from EBDI's vantage point that suggest that there has been a lot of foreclosures that residents have suffered through as a result of a misplanning on the part of the city, and also the occupation of East Baltimore, of EBDI, I'm sorry, in East Baltimore. And to utilize terms that you use, Doug Nelson, to suggest that, we're trying to find our way. So you're using terms such as experiment, but we're talking about human beings that had to be uprooted from their place of reference. And I think that that says a lot about the investment on the part of yourself and the Annie Casey Foundation in terms of your intent. And we do know that this is not the first time that Johns Hopkins and the city has had to do an investigation on these quote-unquote experiments that have been done in East Baltimore. And specifically, I'm referencing the investigation that took place in the early to mid-90s with the lead poisoning cases that families brought up. And the lead poisoning issue, of course, came up as the demolition started happening in the latter part of the 2000s of this decade. So from my particular view of things, I would not call it a perspective, because it is a reality that people have suffered through the mounds of paperwork, the mounds of discussions that have certainly led people out of their place of reference. And that's not something that you can surmount in a dollar. You can't really cover that part up. So I think the reporting from the Daily Record has allowed for at least the opening of a conversation to discuss the reality of what has happened that you guys are still calling an experiment. And it's certainly not an experiment that you're willing to look after over time, which is longevity. And as you talk about the generations that you have had to confront with your experiment, you certainly have not said from an EBDI's perspective that we're going to monitor you for the rest of your life since we are still doing this experiment on you to see if this urban renewal project actually works, because we all calling it a revolution in urban development.
Right.
And you're being backed by millions of dollars, or in fact $1.8 billion, as it relates to the estimated amount that it will cost to do an entire project. But we don't see a biotech. We don't see that. Those things that were proposed in the beginning to get the federal dollars that Chris Shea just mentioned, we don't see that. But what we do see is we see patches of land that generations of people lived on. And, of course, I do know that there's a lot of parties involved in what has happened. So you're right to mention the city and officials who certainly know what's been going on and what's been funneled through EBDI. So it's not to stick it on EBDI solely, but it's to look at the whole context in which, again, this experiment has been dished out upon residents who have lived in East Baltimore historically.
You know, in fairness, let me respond if I could, Mark, and I appreciate that comment. But I think two things are really important to say that I don't think the articles, and I'm not sure that you've done real justice to this. One is when EBDI was launched in 2003, in those 88 acres, the vacancy rate was about 69% of standing structures. The remaining vacant structures were lead-laden, were deteriorating, were not amenable to rehabilitation. And I say this from the point of view of somebody who believes that when you can avoid relocation in a development investment, you ought to do it with your heart and soul. And I don't want anybody to think that EBDI underestimates the trauma or the disruption or the pain and loss that relocation entails. When I say that there's an effort to innovate here, in most urban renewal projects, two things are true. One, the folks that were relocated were not tracked by anybody. Their status was not documented or that no assistance followed them. You look at the Hope 6 projects in Baltimore, and I dare you to find out where the poor folks are today who lived in those structures that came down. East Baltimore was committed, and I, you know, the record here is the Casey Foundation was a early supporter of and continuous supporter of SMEAC, because we felt that that would create a dialogue about the response to this redevelopment proposal of the cities. SMEAC helped negotiate a relocation package that I think should be noted that housing values on average in phase one for people who were being relocated were $28,000. They were dropping $2,000 a year. If you invested in your own house, it was likely that any improvements to your own house would be eroded by declining property values. That was the reality in a neighborhood in which 70% of the houses were vacant, including very often houses that had vacant houses next to them with common walls, which prevented their effective rehabilitation. When the decision was made that you couldn't rebuild decent, safe, healthy, lead-free housing in that neighborhood without creating some temporary cleared land for redevelopment purposes, the issue was relocation benefits. On average, homeowners went from $28,000 of market value in their house to $150,000 or $60,000 of equity in other homes in Baltimore as a result of relocation. Part of the question about how federal money was used is it was used to give decent, just, fair, and generous benefits to the people who were impacted by this urban renewal project.
But were people done with SMEAC at the table saying that
make us whole. Give us an option to live in houses with the same number of bedrooms, with the same amenities as we would wished we could create in our own homes in our historic neighborhood. And I think it's important to say that three surveys of those folks, and I don't mean to diminish what Mindy Fully Love and everybody else who has even the remotest notion of what it's like to be uprooted are saying about the trauma of that. But It is also true that most of the people relocated report that the process was equitable and that their quality of life is improved, not because there was anything wrong with Middle East, except for the fact that it was a neighborhood that was 30% occupied with crime, health, lead level statistics, which were really not compatible with raising children.
So you're stating that their lives are better off now that they're not in East Baltimore.
I'm saying that when one evaluates the impact of this redevelopment on families, one has to ask the question, which is precisely the question I asked myself at Casey when the city and Hopkins invited us to join. What happens to those people, their children, the seniors in East Baltimore, if none of us do anything? And I wish that Joan and Melody had asked the question, what would have happened to that population that was remaining there, 30% occupied housing, declining values? You know, the whole argument about the TIF, Mark, that's raised is the tax base on that 88 acres was less than $100,000 in 2003. Less than $100,000. That is, value had gone out of that neighborhood. Well, it wasn't the residents' fault.
Let me just wait for a minute. We have a lot of people calling in, and I know you want to get in here, Josh, but let me just throw this question, and then, Josh, you can come in as well. There are a couple of reality checks here that I remember from the conversations we had. I mean, the reason that the federal funds were used and pushed to ensure that residents of the Middle East had houses was because they had to fight the organization to make that happen.
Exactly.
It didn't just happen. I mean, it was a fight to make that happen.
It was not an introduction to redevelopment in that way to say, would you like for this to happen, or how do you feel about your neighborhood? It was all a monetary value, meaning it was time in the residents' perspective of things. It was time to cash in on the gold mine is how they would put that, what you just said, Mark.
And it wasn't also that from what I was reading in this story, and so this is true or not true, that the demolition was paid for with a combination of foundation funds, city bond funds from the TIFs sales, because the federal funds were supposed to pay for it, but had to be diverted to relocation. Isn't that part of what happened?
The source of demolition was largely city GO bond funds at the time. Yeah, so I don't know anything about any diversion or there was no TIF at the time of that initial demolition. That TIF wasn't in place at that time. So TIF funds couldn't have been used. But the city had committed at the time significant resources in terms of its GO bond funds for demolition.
Now, what Josh, all you want to say is I'll let you come in, then everybody come back. What were you going to say?
Well, first of all, I want to say thanks for having me on. I wanted to respond to a couple points that have come up. First of all, very briefly, I'm looking at one of the APT surveys, and I think something that goes unnoted in a lot of these claims that 85% of the residents were happy is that the response rate was 56%. Well, 44%, we don't know if there's a response bias there, a non-response bias. That's a brief point that I just want to make that never seems to come up, is that only about half the people in this 2005 survey were found and asked these questions. Now, moving on, we could talk about the history all night, but that's not what I read in the MDR as the main focus. I mean, for me, from my vantage point, there were two main points that came up. The first point was what happened to the biotech, if anything. And I think Melody and Joan call into question. I think it squares with what I've heard Mr. Shea say. I think it squares with what I've heard from other people, that the biotech part of this project does not look the same and, in fact, has declined significantly from what it was planned to be. And I think because, as Mr. Nelson has said repeatedly, employment and the multi-generational angle and what sort of jobs were going to be available. When you talk about really investing deeply in benefiting the poor people, the question was what sort of jobs were going to come out of this? And the job training was very heavily predicated on biotech as well as construction. And because the biotech's being downscaled, both in terms of number of jobs and in terms of the size of the buildings, both of those job sectors are going to take a hit. That was initially supposed to benefit not only the relocated residents, but those who stayed behind and their neighbors. There are huge questions that this opens up about that. So first of all, I have to say that was very amenable to this reporting. I haven't heard a response to that yet. The second thing, as a Hopkins grad student, as someone who's taken a very long look at the Hopkins involvement, is that Hopkins' role in this project has exploded. voted. And, you know, President Daniels can say, quote unquote, Johns Hopkins doesn't own or control any land within the EBDI district. But as far as I know, one of the two or three most active construction projects in the piano right now is a 570 grad student residential tower. Now, we can get into whether that's really within the boundary or not, but that's part of EBDI's plans. So he can say Hopkins doesn't own or control any land, but that's a 570-person grad tower going up where these people used to live, where they used to walk, where they used to work. And I think there are very real questions about what Hopkins' role is going to be. I think some of these questions are generated from comments that were made back in May at Hopkins about Hopkins being the center, the economic engine, about Hopkins faculty, Hopkins staff, what sort of retail was going to go in, what the school was going to look like to draw these people in, and the emphasis on middle class, middle class, middle class, the emphasis on Johns Hopkins Medical Institution personnel being different from other people in Baltimore in their willingness to relocate to a place like the Middle East was repeatedly emphasized. And to me, that really runs the risk of sounding like gentrification. Absolutely. And that's not deep investment in benefiting the poor any more than the biotech or the construction looks like it's going to work out that way. And I think they did a terrific job of highlighting both of those issues in this article. And so I think setting the rest of the reportage aside, those are two huge questions that I think I have. I'm not going to speak for anyone else. I can only speak for myself, but I'll stop there and let
Before we open the phones, let me let the response.
There's no question that the pace of expansion of biotech facilities is slower than intended. The idea that it's been shelved or that no one recognizes that proximity to Hopkins isn't an important contributor, an important economic engine, is wrong. And the fact that we've got a Maryland public health lab coming into it, I think will sort of deepen the presence of biotech-related jobs. But the larger issue, Josh, is that the biotech engine, which will someday hopefully produce a tax base that will allow investment in the infrastructure of the larger east side, the catalytic effect of these 88 acres, if you have the long view. And I'm begging people to take the long view because you cannot fix this neighborhood overnight. And so the long view makes a huge difference. Let's remember that there isn't a grocery store in that neighborhood. There isn't a grocery store in that neighborhood. And that is symbolic, not itself an anchor, but it is symbolic. There is not a good school in that neighborhood, which is, I think, an important issue that has been on the table from the beginning. Melody and Joan give the impression that this was biotech, all biotech, nothing but biotech. And the truth of the matter was there were lots of investors and participants, including, I think, lots of community folks who said, if this is a multifaceted commitment to create an environment in which families, poor, middle class, and others – professionals can raise children successfully, that would be worth the risk taking and the investment that the city would probably make.
But if you displace residents, how is all of these grandiose ideas going to benefit the people who historically lived there if you move them out? Now, there was a lot of propaganda that was disseminated, which was expressed verbally and written communication to suggest that where you live is already devastating, not creating a conversation or a level of engagement that says, well, we know that we are creating a state of bedlam for you as we are occupying the place in which you all grew up. But we are looking at the negative aspects of it, and we are going to promote that to you so that you can make a decision whether or not you want to stay in your home. And I think that that is a fundamental issue. And to have buy-in from the residents from that particular standpoint, I'm not sure how you're able to sit here and say that we have made progress.
Can I ask you one question, Mark? One question, because I think it's a critical question. Let me ask a question. Both Josh, you've been a participant. Shabria, you've been a leader in the community. What would have happened in East Baltimore if, as was the case from 1990 to 2004, there was no major investment in that community, either by the public sector or the philanthropic sector. That's
a misleading counterfactual. Yeah. I mean, it was a crime, the disinvestment that took place, and no one was held responsible. It was a crime that Hopkins.
Well, let me agree with that.
And the rest of the stakeholders here stood by.
That when we talk about I remember the early conversations we had when this project first started, and the biotech labs were a huge part of this thing. So two questions. I mean the state lab is being built on property that was going to be where the private biotech lab was. So
one of them was.
So it's not probably not going to generate new jobs, and it's also not going to give us a tax base because it's a public facility. So, I mean, that A. And B, what happened that University of Maryland built this huge biotech facility over and over again, making all this progress in the West Side? What happened in the intervening years that it didn't get built and with such a medical behemoth as Hopkins, who is now building, as they pointed out in the story, are building their biotech labs, who are investing all the money in Montgomery County rather than the east side of Baltimore.
Yeah, I don't think they've invested any money in Montgomery County, or are building anything in Montgomery County. There's the complaint that they're doing that, but I don't think it's factually correct. I think the difference between the east side and west side is pretty significant. I think they're very different projects. If you look at the EBDI project, it is in fact an 88-acre neighborhood. It includes a huge social agenda of housing, of workforce development, of building and operating a new public school, building and operating an early childhood center. There's none of that on the West Side. The University of Maryland has none of that responsibility, none of that cost, none of that time associated with putting a project of that scale together. It's a three-block, 10-acre commercial development and nothing more. I mean, and it's positive. And it complements the overall strategy for the development of life sciences in Baltimore and in Maryland as a state. But it's a very, very different project. And because of the aspiration in East Baltimore to literally rebuild a neighborhood, and I want to get to some of the comments about housing and the opportunities for the original residents to live there, to rebuild a neighborhood that, in fact, accommodates 100% of the original residents who choose to remain or who choose to come back. We have been very public in declaring that each and every resident, original resident of East Baltimore, who would like to remain or who would like to come back, we guarantee them a spot in an affordable and permanent way. The very first residential units that we built, in fact, the residential units we have in place today, there are 215 units of affordable rental units. We didn't build market rate rental. The very first for sale units or owner-occupied units that we're sponsoring, there are 40 units under construction now for existing and returning East Baltimore residents. We need to serve those residents first and accommodate 100% of the demand of those residents to come back. The reality is these folks have been provided the opportunity to make a choice. Do I want to live in East Baltimore? Do I want to trust these guys and what they say about what's going to happen in East Baltimore? Or do I want to take my resource and move somewhere else? And a substantial number of people have said, for whatever reason, I want to move to Blair Edison. I want to move to Frankfurt Estates. I want to move to the West Side. And I think we have an obligation to support people to do that. Today, if any one of them were to call me up and say, I'm having second thoughts, I want to come back, I have every ability to accommodate them in East Baltimore and to bring them back.
And when you say you have every ability, can you clarify that by means of how that's going to happen? Are you going to assist residents in selling their property and coming up with a monetary settlement amount and things of that nature? Can you explain that?
Yep. We're actually surveying the residents now to understand from their point of view what they perceive to be the obstacles to coming back. We're essentially going to them and say, you know, maybe you didn't believe us before. We hope you're beginning to see that we've made good on our promises. What is it? What would it take to bring you back? What is it you're afraid of? Is it selling your house? Is it you're afraid because the current real estate market is a difficult one and you won't be able to sell your house and come back? Tell us if that's the answer, if that's the issue. We can figure that out with you. We can work with you.
How long has that line of questioning been going on? Because I know I came into SMEAC before they dissolved back in the latter part of 2009 and the early part of 2007. And before 2008, well, there were at least 150 people who came out to a SMEAC-led meeting to say, we want to stay here. Mm-hmm. But there was no viable option for them to do that.
Send me that sign-in sheet so I can get
it. Right.
Is it fair to say, though, that there are, I mean, if you want to move back, I mean, there are any houses for them to move back into?
I have 215 units of rental housing available. We held that off the market in three phases. And we held that off the market for 90 days and marketed exclusively to East Baltimore residents to make them available for them to come back. 38 people took advantage of that. The balance went unclaimed. The balance went undesired.
And that's not surprising. I mean, moving is hard enough in the first place, especially as traumatic as it was the first time. And moving and you know, you can talk about the marketing surveys and the rebranding that Melody and Joan bring up, but I think there are huge questions about why the surveys and focus groups that are being done now. And weren't done, because some of the questions aren't just about, in this tough real estate market, are you afraid of selling your house? Some of the questions are, what sort of neighborhood would you like to move back to? Well, those questions, and they're going out to Hopkins students, they're going out to Hopkins faculty, and it's 2011 and we're getting these questions from a marketing survey. And we didn't see those questions 2 years ago. I was here. I didn't get that survey 2 years ago or 4 years ago or even 6 years ago. These aren't new problems. These aren't new questions that should be coming up. These were questions that should have been asked at the first place. And you really haven't addressed what I think for me is a central question, which is, if people choose to move back, what sort of neighborhood are they going to be moving back into? Because right now, the picture Melody and Joan paint, the picture I'm seeing, I'm hearing, is one of a project that has gone from, I'm sorry, with all due respect, biotech was all we heard about when I first started coming to EBDI meetings. That was central plank of what this project was about. And now we're hearing things that sound much more like a traditional urban renewal project. And we're hearing things that, as I said, quite frankly sound like gentrification. And if I were a relocated resident, there is no way, and I'm not trying to speak for him, but just speaking for myself, there's no way I want to move back to the sort of neighborhood where Commonwealth Avenue in Boston is held up as the example of what we want Broadway to look like. And that was the example. And
let me just say real quick, Doug, please respond, but we have like a minute and 30 seconds left. I want to apologize to Michael Nee and all the other callers. We couldn't get to it. Your calls, because it was such an intense conversation in the studio here, so I apologize for that. But, Doug, you have about a minute left, a minute and a half.
Well, you know, it's Josh, it's unfair, I think, to suggest that people are committed to gentrification. It is unfair from my vantage point.
I didn't say people were committed to gentrification.
I know, but you gave that impression.
No. I am not talking about intent.
All right.
I am talking about what the realities on the ground seem to be.
All right, so let's talk about the realities on the ground. There are about 600 residents that have returned to the rental, the workforce rental housing, the senior housing, the Penrose.
600 residents, but you're not talking relocated residents. You're just talking in general.
In general, right. including many from the greater East Baltimore, surrounding East Baltimore, and including relocatees. Mm-hmm. And we know, and you're well aware of it, and SMEAC designed the program that Chris is making reference to, the House for a House program and the rehab program. There are now 40 under construction that are going to go exclusively.
But how many residents are actually living, who stayed in the community? How many people are living there? To my understanding, there's about maybe three people or two, which is
the
Lisa
rehab
Francis
and the House for a House
Donald
contract.
Gresham, who were affiliated with SMEAC before they resolved.
Let me finish, though. The question of gentrification, I think, is an important one. Let me just state the fact. We have about 600 residents in the area. What is the economic level, Josh? You tell me of those 600 residents and
Doug, I deeply apologize, but we have to break. We're at the top of the hour. We have barely touched the surface of this, and I would like to figure out a way that we can have the dialogue one on one in a group again because if this is about the future of the city, which it is, as you were quoted in the paper saying, then we have to come back to this, and we've really barely touched the surface, and this deserves more time than we're giving it today. But I want to thank all of being here, Doug Nelson, Chris Shea, Shabria Thomas, Josh Garin. Thank you all for coming in the studio today. And sorry to the callers, we couldn't get you through today. This is just too intense inside the studio to get to the phone, so I do apologize for that. On the way out, let me say, make sure I have this right, and where is my paper? I'm looking for it right here. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services, routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information, 1-800-492-5538 or www.umm.edu/womencenter. Thank you all for being with us today. Mark Steiner Show's production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. I'm Mark Steiner for 88.9 WEAA, the voice of the community. Thanks for listening to us, and take care.